everyone who loves books. This is Read on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show recorded at the RNIB Talking Book Studios. I'm your host, Red Sail, and this week, Marilyn Davidson Elliott introduces us to The Blind Mechanic, the amazing story of Eric Davidson, survivor of the 1917 Halifax explosion.
The whole district of Richmond, where my father lived, was completely flattened.
We go in search of lost Yeti treasure with Amelia Fang's creator, Laura Ellen Anderson.
Amelia Fang, so she is a brave and determined vampire, and she goes on lots of adventures with her best friends Florence and Grimaldi, and also Prince Tangine Le Floufou I, future king of Nocturnia.
Sita Brahmachari imagines a post-apocalyptic world in which children must pollinate plants.
And then at the age of 11, the deal is that those children who've had a functional education go off to the pollinating farms for their little fingers to pollinate the crops.
And writer Gary Young shares the books of his life. That's all coming up in today's Read On. In 1917, a ship laden with munitions exploded in the Canadian port of Halifax. Hundreds of people were killed and injured, including 2-year-old Eric Davidson, who was blinded. This didn't stop him becoming a renowned automotive mechanic and somewhat of a local celebrity. Now his daughter Marilyn has written a biography of his extraordinary life, The Blind Mechanic, The Amazing Story of Eric Davidson. It's been simultaneously published in print and audio, and Marilyn joined me down the line to tell me more. So the story of your father is a fascinating story that could have been tragic, but is actually incredibly uplifting. Just tell us a little bit about Eric's life.
Well, my father, Eric, was blinded in the Halifax explosion in 1917. He was only 2.5 at the time. And he went to the school for the blind in Halifax. And after finishing school, he wanted to train to become an automobile mechanic. And that opportunity was denied him because in the 30s and 40s and for several decades afterwards, if you were blind, there were certain jobs that you did, and certainly they weren't willing to allow him to attend trade school to become a mechanic. Not willing to accept that denial, he taught himself to be an automobile mechanic, and I guess fortunate for him, but unfortunate for the times, it was the Second World War. And there was a shortage of skilled labor in Halifax, and so therefore he got the opportunity to work as an automobile mechanic and proved himself, and as they say, the rest is history.
Now, this explosion in the harbour in Halifax, Nova Scotia, it was a munition ship called Mont Blanc that blew up, and it caused pretty widespread devastation.
Yes, it did. Roughly 2,000 people died on the day or a few days afterwards. 9,000 were injured, roughly, and 25,000 homeless. The whole district of Richmond, where my father lived, was completely flattened. A doctor who attended later in the day on a relief train described it as Dante's Inferno. So it was just horrific.
That generation of your whole family was caught up in it. And I suppose that must have led to a feeling with your father that actually he was lucky to be alive rather than unlucky to have been blinded.
Yes, and that's the attitude he took. And that's the way he raised us, to be grateful for what you do have and not moan and go on about what you don't have. He certainly considered himself very lucky to survive because he knew so many other families in time who had lost several members. For instance, one woman lost 10 of her children and her husband, but she lived. So there were so many horrific stories like that that those who survived quickly realized they were the fortunate ones.
Were there many other people blinded in the explosion who he would have gone to school with and grown up with?
Well, yes, there was roughly around 230 people who were now. They used the word blinded, but they weren't totally blinded. Some of them may have lost one eye or the vision in one eye. What it came down to, there were 18 who lost both of their eyes, so who had both of their eyes enucleated or removed. My father was the youngest survivor to lose both of his eyes. And of those 18, there were only a few children, perhaps three or four, and he did know those children and kept in touch with them throughout his life.
And as you say, he focused on what he could still achieve rather than on what he lost. He sounds like a very determined man, but in a very positive and rather jolly way.
Absolutely, yes. He was a quiet rebel, I guess you would say. He certainly didn't stir the pot, but I guess, like I said, I compare you to him because he wasn't prepared to accept that maybe he couldn't do something. He was certainly going to try to do it with a positive attitude, and there was very little he didn't manage to do.
Now, your mother was also blind, wasn't she?
Yes, she was born with cataracts because her mother had rubella when she was carrying her.
And they both were members of the Canadian National Institute for the Blind, your version of the RNIB, which I believe was founded only a year after the explosion in 1918.
That is correct, yes. They were in the throes of establishing a CNIB because of the men who were coming back from the First World War who had been blinded or visually injured, and the Halifax explosion just pushed that forward that much quicker.
And it was a lifelong relationship between your father and CNIB. I believe after he retired, he volunteered for them as well.
He didn't actually volunteer for the CNIB. He volunteered on his own at seniors' residences and at a veterans' hospital, where he would go and either play his banjo for the veterans, or he would just listen to their stories and chat with them. But yes, through the CNIB, he was associated and a client throughout his life, as was my mother. But no, he didn't do any volunteer work for them. He was employed by them before he became a mechanic.
Oh, right. Okay. Well, what did he do for them?
I guess the best description would be that he tried to match people up with jobs.
So an employment advisor.
Yes, I don't know that there was an actual title for it, but...
Using his experience of the workplace to help other people back to work.
That's right, to find a job or jobs. And back in that time, the majority of positions for blind persons was caning chairs, piano tuning, working in a canteen. You know, they were menial jobs, and he didn't want to do that. He wanted to do what had been his lifelong dream.
And succeeded and really blazed a trail. I believe he was quite a celebrity within his own lifetime.
He was, but he was a very humble and modest man. And, you know, he would shy away from notoriety as best he could. But it always found him. It wasn't common to have a blind mechanic. And once he got his license in Nova Scotia, he went to Ontario, which was a couple of thousand miles away, to work. And when word got around there that there was a blind mechanic working in town, the media interviewed him, and that was the way it was the rest of his life. He just amazed people, and that never stopped his entire life. And in Halifax, he was pretty much the visual, I guess, survivor of the Halifax explosion. There were several hundred others over the years, but they didn't have a visual injury that people could identify with, whereas my father did. And he walked all over the city with his white cane. He was so easily identifiable.
And I believe that there's a sports playing field in Halifax that's named in his honour as well.
Yes, that is correct. The J. Eric Davidson Sports Field, which is on Fort Needham, and that is a memorial park to the memory of the victims of the Halifax explosion.
And a film was made about him within his lifetime?
Yes, a documentary was made about my father. The National Film Board of Canada gave a documentary about him in 1975, and it's called Just One of the Boys.
It strikes me that if you're a car mechanic and you're taking engines to pieces and dealing with the electrics in a car, you would have to be an incredibly methodical person. Was he, like a lot of us who are blind, a little bit obsessive about making sure that everything was in its place so that he could find it again?
Absolutely. When he took an engine apart, he laid the pieces out in a specific order. And he knew where each piece was when he had to go back to it to replace it. So yes, he was very methodical.
And presumably he could hear what the problem was in an engine in the same way that a sighted mechanic would have been able to see it.
That's right, and that's how he did diagnose various problems in the workings of an engine. And it was very common for friends, neighbors to bring their cars to my father. I remember so vividly people coming while we would be having our supper and knocking on the door, oh, Eric, could you come out and listen to my car and tell me what's wrong with it?
And I believe he extended his interest in all things you could hear to recording things on a tape recorder.
That's correct. He certainly enjoyed recording various sounds and replaying them over and over at his leisure. Those sounds could include us children playing, Christmas mornings, frogs peeping in the spring, a locomotive engine, an automobile engine, anything and everything he recorded.
Did you use those recordings when you came to do your research for the biography that you've written of him?
Yes, I had to actually go out and purchase a reel-to-reel tape recorder because that's old technology. And I had all these old tapes that my father had made, but I hadn't listened to them for many years. And I had to go out and buy a machine so that I could do that. And in so doing, I came across some very treasured tapes, one in particular when I was only 2 years old, and it was Christmas morning, and very touching.
Now, he lived to a ripe old age, and it was only a few years after his death that you sat down and started to write the book. Did you not feel that you could do so during his lifetime?
I wanted to during his lifetime, but as I said, he was a humble and modest man, and the notoriety that my book has brought would have happened while he was living, and I just don't think he would have been comfortable with it. So it was not something I pursued with him while he was living. I just knew that he wouldn't welcome it, not because, you know, he didn't want his story to be told per se, but he was just so humble and private, and I couldn't have invaded his privacy like that.
Well, it's a wonderful tribute to a life lived positively, well, and as you say, humbly. And very fittingly, it's available as an audiobook, which is read rather beautifully by Jan Crowley. Did you have anything to do with asking her to be the narrator?
No, I did ask the CNIB if they could collaborate to get an audible book version, and they are, the CNIB recorded it, and she is a CNIB volunteer in Toronto.
And I believe that you're a CNIB volunteer as well.
Yes, I do. We have a walking club, and I'm one of the guides in our walking club, and we weekly take walks through the various parks in Halifax. It's lovely.
Eric's memory lives on not only in the book, but also I hear that the Guide Dog Association has helped perpetuate his name too.
Yes, one of the latest pups that is now in training in Halifax is named Eric after my father. Yeah, a little, well, he's not so little anymore, black lamb.
Oh, lovely. Well, finally, I wonder, was Eric a big fan of talking books? And if so, do you think he had a favourite?
Dad listened to a lot of talking books. He liked to listen to various programs on the radio. My mother was an avid talking book reader, listener. And growing up, we heard a lot of talking books, and they opened the world up for my mother. And the CNIB is also making my book available in a Braille version. And that is because I knew that my mother, who also read Braille avidly, would have wanted that.
Well, let's hope that The Blind Mechanic, the story of your father, Eric Davidson, also goes into the RNIB library in a full range of accessible formats. Meanwhile, I know that we can find it commercially where people buy their books online, and I hope many more people come to enjoy the fascinating and uplifting life of your father, Eric Davidson. Marilyn Elliott Davidson, thank you so much for being a guest on Read On, and enjoy the rest of your holiday in the UK.
Thank you so much, Red. It's been a pleasure.
A steadfast North Ender all of his life, Eric Davidson was an iconic figure, being one of the most recognized survivors of the Halifax explosion as he walked the city streets with his white cane. Local people who did not know him personally knew him as the man who was blinded in the explosion, or as the blind mechanic. Dad was never bitter about his handicap. The fact that he was blinded was of small consequence to him, for he believed his family was lucky to survive the Halifax explosion. When he was interviewed for the A&E television programme Sea Tales in 1992, he said, "We were all injured, and we all recovered, and we were one of the luckiest families in the city, I think. My father did not seek recognition. It found him. It was most unusual for someone without sight to have a career as an auto mechanic and to accomplish all the things that my father did in his lifetime. The media, like everyone who met Dad, were fascinated by him, for he was truly a phenomenon. They recognized that his story of survival and accomplishment was one of great public interest."
Jan Crowley narrating The Blind Mechanic, the amazing story of Eric Davidson, written by his daughter, Marilyn Davidson Elliott, out now in print, ebook, and audio, wherever you buy your books online. And it's a fascinating and uplifting read.
Do you get stuck when it comes to technology? Don't worry. Help is at hand with RNIB's Technology Support Squad. We can give you advice over the phone or visit you at home to help you master your technology. Help is at hand, from setting up a mobile phone and getting the most out of it to using the accessibility features on your PC. Or maybe you need help with your Daisy talking book player. You can email technologysquad@rnib.org.uk and we'll get right back to you. Or call our helpline on 0303 123 9999. That's 0303 123 9999. Get the most out of your technology with RNIB's Technology Support Squad.
The Moth.
I'm Jay Ellison. Join us for more true personal stories told live on stage. No scripts, no notes, no nothing. Each Moth Radio Hour is a mix of funny and heartbreaking tales that captivate and surprise and delight audiences around the world with their honesty and bravery and humor. That's the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Wednesdays from 8 p.m. and Sundays at 11 a.m. on RNIB Connect Radio.
You're listening to Read On, RNIB Connect Radio's one-stop shop for book news, reviews, and author interviews. Still to come in this week's show, a dystopian novel for the Greta Thunberg generation and the books of Gary Young's life. But first, Laura Ellen Anderson is a best-selling author and illustrator, and the creator of the hugely popular Amelia Fang series for young readers. In her latest adventure, Amelia must solve the mystery of the lost Yeti treasures. So, with the spectre of Halloween in the air, Robert Kirkwood donned his cloak and ventured into the darkness of Nocturnia. Here's a clip, narrated by Zoe Thorne.
Birth night bums!
Amelia Fang woke with a start. Her pet pumpkin Squashy rolled off the bed, landing with a padoing.
It can't be night time already, surely, said Amelia, pulling the blanket over her head.
Sounds like the celebrations have started, said Florence Spudwick with a stretch.
Grimaldi Reaperton yelped and hid underneath his bed covers. It was the winter holidays in the Kingdom of the Dark, which meant 6 whole weeks off school. Young vampire Amelia Fang and her 3 best friends were spending the first weekend of their holidays at the Yeti Mountain Pits. The pits were home to all the ancient retired Yetis in the kingdom, each living in their own cosy pit connected by a network of candlelit tunnels. Florence's grand jetty, Clements, was turning 350 years old, and the ancient yetis were having a party all weekend to celebrate.
That's Zoe Thorne, reading from Amelia Fang and the Lost Yeti Treasures by Laura Ellen Anderson, who joins me now. Now, Laura, tell us about Amelia Fang.
Amelia Fang, so she is a brave and determined vampire, and she goes on lots of adventures with her best friends Florence and Grimaldi, and also Prince Tangine Le Floufou the First, future king of Nocturnia. Over the course of the five books, their friendship has really grown and developed, and the books really look at kind of, you know, the bond that they have, and looking at tolerance and acceptance in their world, and they just meet lots of weird and wonderful creatures, and each book sees a new location in the world and takes them on many strange avenues, really.
Now, we've just had Halloween. Why do you think kids, especially at this time of year, love spooky things so much?
I think it's the thrill of the scare. We all like to be scared a little bit. I know I'm not very good with very scary books or movies. I thought The Witches was pretty scary. The Witches by Roald Dahl, I must add, and illustrated beautifully by Quentin Blake. But I think it's a bit like going on a roller coaster. You know it's going to be scary, but it's that excitement and that kind of adrenaline rush you get. And then getting to the end of the book is almost like facing your fear and then kind of sharing that excitement and the kind of scary thrill with your friends. I think kids like that. And whenever I go to events and I ask kids if they like to read books that are a bit scary, pretty much 90% of the audience will put their hands up.
Now, everything seems to have a touch of gothic. So what or who has inspired you?
I adore the work of creator and director Tim Burton. I love his stop motion animations, especially The Nightmare Before Christmas and Corpse Bride, and highly influenced by film and animation. So films such as Casper the Friendly Ghost and The Addams Family have really resonated with me through the years. So I just love the character development and the world, and there's just something really warming, and it's, they're not too scary. They're very gentle movies as such. But I just love the atmosphere around anything Halloween-y and slightly spooky, and the kind of mischievous, creepy characters that you get in those kinds of animations and films.
Nocturnia certainly has that sort of feel, but it's the opposite of cute because glitter there is terrifying.
Yes. So the creatures, I like to describe them as being just like any one of us, just a bit hairier with a few more spiky teeth. And I like to turn the kind of traditional elements on their heads. So the vampires, they do have reflections, and they don't drink blood. They're just like you or I. They have their own personal problems and challenges to work through in everyday life, but it's just put in a bit more of a weird and wonderful twist on those characters to make it more interesting. So hopefully the reader can relate to some of the things Amelia and her friends are going through and kind of empathise with the characters, but see it from a slightly different, it's different way to make it a bit more relatable as well. But Nocturnia is not meant to be scary, and they are terrified of glitter and they are terrified of the creatures of the light, although we see progression in that throughout the books from 1 to 3 in particular.
Now, talking of which, what do unicorn farts smell like?
I'd say they smell like a mixture of magnificence and I'd say glitter. Glitter, magnificence and everything that's wonderful in the world.
Now, we've mentioned Halloween. There's also World Book Day. Do you ever get kids dressing up as Amelia?
I do. It's so lovely. It's quite nice because we have World Book Day at the beginning of the year, and I've had some fabulous photos sent to me of various kids dressed up as Amelia Fang and other characters. One of the funniest was a mother sending a picture of her Florence costume, which she ended up using the mask, the head of Florence, as a car seat cover in the end. And then you have Halloween, where they can kind of revisit the character. And, you know, the fact that Amelia Fang is going to be a World Book Day book for 2020 is just really, really good news, because, you know, it's an opportunity for more kids to discover the world and perhaps dress up if they fancy it.
Now, we know most of the Amelia Fang books are in audio. Did you have a hand in picking Zoe Thorne as the narrator?
I did. So I had a few options, and I really loved Zoe Thorne's take on... I was actually, when I listened to her first sample, it was of her reading another book, but her voice was so expressive, and she does such an amazing job of the characters. I love the way she approaches the characters' dialogue, especially Grimaldi's voice. And it's really nice to hear someone else reading the characters in their own special way. But I think the audiobooks are so brilliantly done, and Zoe Thorne was such an amazing choice. I'm so glad that she's doing the books and is signed up to do Yeti Treasures and the next book too.
Did you not think about doing it yourself?
I don't think... I think someone else could do it much better than me. I trip over my words way too much. I like to write and illustrate and then let someone else bring the characters to life. I think there's a real joy in that and seeing their kind of twist on the characters too.
So the latest book, The Lost Yeti Treasures, tell us about that one.
So Amelia and her friends, Florence Grimaldi and Tangine, they're off to the Yeti Mountain Pits to celebrate Florence's grand Yeti Clemence's 350th birth night party. But whilst they're there over the course of the weekend, the ancient Yetis who live there, a lot of their precious belongings start to go missing. And then the actual mountains themselves start to crumble. And so the Yetis are at risk of losing their home forever. So Amelia and her friends take it upon themselves to find out what's going on, get to the bottom of it, and quite literally in the pits, and find out who or what is behind all of these strange goings on. So it's there's a bit of mild peril, lots of adventure, and some brand new characters that we meet at the end.
Now, as I said, we're recording this around Halloween. What's your favourite part of this time of year?
I just love the atmosphere of this. I love autumn. I'm completely obsessed with pumpkins, so any excuse to fill my flat with pumpkins. But I love it when it starts to get a little bit colder, not too cold, but cold enough to wear huge snuggly jumpers and wrap up in scarves, and that wood smoke smell in the air. There's something very magical about this time of year, and I can't put my finger on it, but I just know that it's always resonating. I think part of it as well, I do remember one time in my life when my little sister was being born, and it was the end of September, and the wood smoke smell, and listening to an audio tape of Plop the Owl Who Was Afraid of the Dark. And that's a really vivid memory I have, the smells, the sounds, the story, and I think it's just got a really special place in my heart.
So do you listen to audiobooks yourself?
I do. I listened to the new Philip Pullman book on audiobook by the lovely Michael Sheen, who was fantastic. And I've listened to, Terry Pratchett's Tiffany Aching book I listened to, or the audio version. And yeah, I think it's great, especially if I'm doing a lot of colour work in my illustrations. I like to put on the audiobooks in the background to listen to whilst doing that, or whilst I'm walking as well. It's lovely. It's almost like someone's keeping you company.
And having the books in audio makes them accessible to people who couldn't access the print books. Is that important to you?
Absolutely. I think the more accessible books are to everyone, the better. And to know that everyone can enjoy the books that I'm writing and listen to the wonderful talents of Zoe Thorne as well, I think it's fantastic.
Now, if someone listening wants to find out more, where can they go?
So they can go onto my website, www.lauraellenanderson.co.uk, and there you can find out more about the books and links to my social media where I babble on about the books and events that are going on. There's an events page where you can keep up to date with where I'll be lurking around signing books with my little Squashy the Pumpkin stamp as well. And I love meeting fans of the books and talking to people, and people can ask questions, and you can also, I've got a fan email as well, and I love snail mail. Always reply to snail mail, because there's something really special about receiving a physical piece of post.
Fantastic. Laura Ellen Anderson, thanks so much for joining me on RNIB Connect Radio.
Thank you so much.
Amelia and her friends were so excited to have a big sleepover together. This meant late day chats, tragic stories by candlelight, and lots of silliness. The door to the pit where Amelia, Florence and Grimaldi were staying burst open. An old Yeti bellowed, "Time for birth night, bums!" before running away.
"Florence, why does everyone keep shouting birth night, bums?"
squeaked Grimaldi from under the covers. The little Grim Reaper was easily alarmed.
"Bum,
bumping bums is a common Yeti greeting, like shaking hands, said Florence as she lit the candles on the walls of the pit. It's tradition to bump bottoms with the birthday Yeti the same number of times as their age.
Wait, isn't your Grand Yeti 350 years old? Said Amelia. That means...
Yup, 350 bum bumps, said Florence.
Thanks to Robert and to Laura Ellen Anderson. Amelia Fang and the Lost Yeti Treasures is out now in print, ebook, and audio, wherever you buy your books. Do you have a book that transports you to a different place? Or maybe you found a hidden gem in the library? Why not drop us a line via the usual email address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. We'd love to hear from you.
Talking Books.
In the Talking Books Library.
With a frenzied, incoherent cry, the ship's surgeon fled the bridge. Within minutes, the entire ship was altered.
Star Trek, the classic episodes.
The library tapes on Cordrazine said that at such dosages, paranoia was a frequent outcome. But McCoy knew the ship too well. By the time a search was organized, he had reached the transporter room and beamed himself down to the planet the Enterprise was orbiting.
The adaptations of almost every single episode from the original series of Star Trek are available on audio from RNIB Talking Books.
Bones! He shouted. No! No! But he was in time only to see McCoy disappear into the cloudy octagonal frame, his body popping out of sight as though it had been swallowed.
There are three volumes mirroring the three seasons of the show. Volume 1 has the episodes from Season 1, including The Naked Time, Shore Leave, The Squire of Gothos, Space Seed, and The City on the Edge of Forever.
What are you? Kirk said.
I am the Guardian of Forever.
Volume 1 is 23 hours 9 minutes long, and it's narrated by William DeFries. Volumes 2 and 3 are read by Hayward Morse. Volume 2 is 25 hours 20 minutes long. Volume 3 is 21 hours 49 minutes long and includes stories such as The Last Gunfight, The Empath, and Spock's Brain.
Damn you, Bones, talk. He was worse than dead.
What do you mean?
Jim, McCoy spoke pleadingly as though he were appealing for mercy from his own sense of helplessness. Jim, his brain is gone.
Star Trek The Classic Episodes, Volumes 1, 2 and 3 are available from the RNIB Talking Books Library. For more information, head to www.rnib.org.uk/talkingbooks.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio. Now, before we go to Gary Young for the books of his life... Sita Brahmachari is an author whose novels for children confront the major topics of our time, including inequality and ecological destruction. Her latest book, Where the River Runs Gold, is set in a post-apocalyptic near future in which two children must risk everything to escape their fate. Sita came to our Camden studio to tell me more. Sita Brahmachari, welcome to Read On.
Thank you very much.
It's a beautiful book set against a rather apocalyptic background. Can you just take us into it for anybody who hasn't read it yet?
Yeah, so Where the River Runs Gold is my first dystopian future adventure story. All of my other stories have been set in the present time. And it was written with a rush of urgency, really, about the present state of the climate. And at the point that I started writing it, Greta Thunberg wasn't a household name, and now there's this young girl who is really changing the world and mobilising millions of people and young people around the world to say we have so little time. And so that was the emotion that this story was written from. So Shifa is the heroine, and her little brother Temba are set in a world where the Kronos hurricane has hit the lands, which is a kind of European landscape, and caused devastation. There's an emergency government, the ARC government, which is made up of a conglomeration of corporations. And the bees population has been devastated, the tree population has been devastated. And most of the people buy into a system in which their children get educated until the age of 11.
their healthcare is looked after and basic work. And then at the age of 11, the deal is that those children who've had a functional education go off to the pollinating farms for their little fingers to pollinate the crops.
It's a chilling vision of what the future for children could be. And yes, as you say, very much a book for the Greta Thunberg generation. What really struck me was the acceptance that only big corporations could possibly sort out this apocalyptic world, which I think is a mindset that really we need to challenge now, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. The society is divided into paragons, who are a tiny, tiny elite, who are also the people that run the corporations and the emergency government. And for these people, the luxuries that are around today seem to still be available. But the majority of people are the ironically named freedoms, who are still tied into this system where they don't seem to be getting much benefit from all of the work that they put in. And then there's the foragers and the outlanders who are challenging the system. And there are rules within this system whereby artwork, storytelling is not encouraged for the freedoms, though it's accessible for the paragons. So all over Kairos City, graffitis are painted by these outlanders and foragers. So they're a sign of resistance everywhere.
Now, the children's father, Nabil, he provides hope. He provides a link to how things were in the past. And he provides a story hive, which gives the children an alternative reality, doesn't it?
Absolutely, yes.
And I know the audiobook is on its way very soon, but you very kindly agreed to read a passage from the book just to give us a flavour.
Absolutely. This is Nabil's story hive. So even amongst the freedom parents and the people that have had to compromise within the system, there are fathers like Nabil who carry the stories of their ancestors with them. Nabil's great-grandparents were refugees from Syria. And they brought nothing with them of possessions, but they brought their stories. And in my lands, it's the ancestors of people who hold on to these stories that will survive. Their story hive had been born when their papa had revealed to them the secret they must never tell, that he had not, after all, allowed the crows to take away all of his books. Here, their minds and hearts had travelled far across Kairos City to the times before the devastation of Hurricane Kronos. Here, they had retained contraband pages discovered in unlikely places around the city, and with these finds, their story hive had expanded into wild deserts, alien planets, raging rivers, bird and butterfly aviaries, the tallest snow-capped mountain ranges and the sweetest flowering meadows. A world away from the rules and regulations of freedom fields.
Chilling. That really hits on the theme that runs throughout the book, that is how important it is for cross-generational relationships, for fathers to pass on stories to children, for grandmothers to be able to mix with the younger generations and give the wisdom of their experience as an alternative to the pervasive thought that is coming from a maybe self-interested government.
So all of my stories are intergenerational, and there are people from babies to the farmer on pollination farm who appears to have dementia. But because Temba, a little boy, I never name him having autism, but he clearly does have autism, because Temba will sit at her feet and listen to her fogged storytelling. He hears in her remembering of what the landscape used to look like, where the beautiful woodlands were, he hears the potential for a brighter future. And without giving away the story, from listening to this ancient woman that remembers a land which was more fertile, he draws a map. And whether this map leads him anywhere, you'll have to find out.
Yes, no spoilers on this show, thank you very much. It strikes me that a lot of dystopian literature, and there is a lot of it around at the moment, is very, very angry and forgets how to be hopeful. Was that a difficult balance for you to strike when actually at the heart of this story is a cry against inequality and ecological destruction?
This was something that was really, really important to me because having my own family, it's very
difficult to grow up in a constant negative narrative on all sorts of areas which are to do with the environment, to do with identity, to do with being a family whose diaspora links are elsewhere in the world, the whole narrative around migration. There are a lot of very negative narratives that are coming to younger generations of people like my children, and I worry about the impact that it has on them. So when I set out on this slightly out of character journey to write a dystopian future novel, but my strong feeling was to do it, that this was a time in which it was needed, hope was really important to me. And so I found it in Shifa and her seed packet. Shifa, the 11-year-old heroine, she makes origami seed packets out of the old bits of paper from the books that are still floating around the city. And so not only does she collect seeds, which she's not allowed to do, wildflower seeds, so she's constantly got on her body a hope for planting something in the future, but she memorizes the pages that she collects the seeds in. So she's constantly growing herself. And for me, it was really important that as the children move through this story, they're constantly questioning, they're constantly growing, and they find in each other some solace. So there's a very tender relationship between Shifa and her brother. And what family is always important in my stories. And what family is a very broad society in my books. So within the Freedom Fields organisation, there are many, many children whose parents have been lost in the Kronos hurricane. So there are children that are brought up by the state, and they are called Ark Freedoms. Now, these children have been brought up without much love, and therefore their behaviour also reflects that. So part of the story is that Shifa and Temba, who've been brought up with the warmth of storytelling and art, albeit in secret, they come to understand if they hadn't had those riches, what they would have been. So empathy is always at the heart of my stories, and for me, empathy is the great hope of this story.
There has been, certainly over the last 5 years, a growth of the numbers of books, especially for children and young adults, where there are female protagonists who I think display more empathy than maybe some of the more traditional male protagonists. And I wonder if maybe that reflects a view that the male model has failed and actually we should be listening to female voices.
Well, it's kind of hard for me to say, actually, because all my heroines of my larger novels have been female. So that's my kind of reality. But I have also written books with male protagonists as well. And I suppose I see the young people, the characters in my stories, as developing people. And so I don't really like to tie them down to the kind of strictures that society places on boys and girls and men and women or whoever we want to be. I see them first and foremost as humans, and they're free. Mm. They're free to be who they want to be, and that's part of the joy of writing.
And voices have an equality of importance.
Yeah.
Temba is an interesting character, as you say. He displays a lot of autistic behaviour, and yet it's not what defines him. What defines him is that he thinks differently. And equality is clearly something that's very important to you as well.
Equality is very linked to me with hope. And I think many of the very destructive forces in the story and in today's world are about inequality. So there is a moment where these children in the school holidays are hungry. And although it's a dystopian novel and I was writing it in the summer holidays, I was deeply conscious that there were children who were hungry. Somebody says about Temba in the story, what is wrong with him? Why does he speak in rhyme? Why does he behave like that? And Shifa says, no, this is Temba. Those are his Temba ways. And as a writer, I just love exploring different ways of seeing the world. And one of the things that I have done, both in this and in my last novel, Tender Earth, is I wanted to create a character who has a difference, where that difference, it isn't what defines them. What defines them is that they are in a relationship with the world of the story. So Shifa and Temba are brother and sister. And that's why Temba's in the story. And therefore, as a writer, my job is to fully express his world in the story. So I learned a huge amount from Temba. I have a brother-in-law who has autism, and I've seen him throughout my life and the difficulties that he's faced and the way that, you know, we go out for a walk and sometimes the way that people view him and then they view us and they wonder about the relationships. I see placing Temba at the heart of this story. It's not, and never ever mentioning that he has autism, as being part of us as a society meeting each other, not as separate entities.
Don't label him, accept him for who he is as an individual.
Yeah.
Now, I know that the audiobook version of Where the River Runs Gold has just been finished, and it clearly is very important to you that everybody should be able to access the story. Did you have anything to do with the selection of the narrator?
I have a very special relationship with the narrator of all of my stories. Actually, I've known all of the people that have narrated my stories. One is Tanya Rodriguez, who has recorded this story, and the other is Juliet Stevenson, who recorded Kite Spirit. And I have sat down and answered questions about the characters, the way that they speak, if they should speak in various accents. So this is something that you don't get the opportunity to do unless you know the readers of your books. And I first met Tanya Rodriguez in the theatre when we worked together on Midnight's Children with the Royal Shakespeare Company, and I did the education work. So we know each other very well. And one of the things that is amazing about Tanya is, from her cultural identity, she fully understands where I'm coming from in terms of the power of story. She records a lot of books, and she also understands from her own cultural perspective how Nabil has allowed the stories to move forward as a way of freeing the children. And this feels really important to me, that this book gets to as many people as possible so that they don't feel trapped in these spaces of not having access. It just goes back to the equality discussion.
Well, it's going to be available soon for download, and hopefully it'll also be coming to the RNIB Talking Books Library. But in the meantime, Sita Brahmachari, thank you so much for taking us into the dystopian world of Where the River Runs Gold and for reading that beautiful passage.
That was my pleasure. Thank you.
Where the River Runs Gold is out now in print and ebook. Gary Young is an author and columnist. His book, Another Day in the Death of America, is a heartbreaking examination of US gun culture, race relations, and news reporting. The talking book version was narrated by Damien Lynch at the RNIB Talking Book Studios in Camden, where I invited Gary to share the books of his life. So, Gary, was there a book that you read as a youngster that made you want to become a writer?
Well, there were some that made me want to write. I don't know they maybe want to become a writer, but I would. Catherine Arai was a big one. I must have been about 15, which is prime time for Catherine Arai. And there was something about Salinger's deft, irreverent style that you, at 15, wanted to imitate, wanted to, you know, the mocking tone of it, the kind of calling everybody phonies. I mean, I got to say, it wasn't for quite some time afterwards that I realised that Holden Caulfield had a mental health, was having a mental health crisis. You know, when I've reread it since, kind of thinking, God, he's a real pain in the arse, actually. He's a kind of,
the kid you don't want as your own.
yeah. But, he was the kid I wanted to be somehow. And then the other one was, The Colour Purple, which I would have been 17 when I read. And which just, you know, done as it is with letters, there is something about, in terms of making you want to write, the kind of facility of thinking, well, I can write a letter. And once again, it's very colloquial and vivid and compelling, and kind of the kind of lines like, you know, I think it pisses God off if you pass the colour purple and you don't appreciate it. And just kind of, you know, needing to kind of take a minute and kind of more than a minute and kind of think about what that meant. So I would go for those two.
If you really want to hear about it, the first thing you probably want to know is where I was born and what my lousy childhood was like and how my parents were occupied and all before they had me and all that David Copperfield kind of crap. But I don't feel like going into it. In the first place, that stuff bores me, and in the second place, my parents would have about 2 hemorrhages apiece if I told anything pretty personal about them. They're quite touchy about anything like that, especially my father. They're nice and all, I'm not saying that, but they're also touchy as hell.
You better not never tell nobody but God. It'd kill your mammy. Dear God, I am 14 years old. I have always been a good girl. Maybe you can give me a sign letting me know what is happening to me. Last spring after little Lucius come, I heard them fussing. He was pulling on her arm. She say, "It too soon, Fonso. I ain't well." Finally, he leave her alone. A week go by, he pulling on her arm again. She say, "No, I ain't gonna. Can't you see I'm already half dead and all of these children?" She went to visit her sister doctor over Macon, left me to see after the others. He never had a kind word to say to me. Just say, "You gonna do or your mammy wouldn't."
The Catcher in the Rye by J.D. Salinger is available in Braille, giant print, and as TB1922, which is narrated by Marvin Kane. The Colour Purple by Alice Walker is available in Braille, giant print, and as TB13312, which is narrated by Lorelei King.
And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
Catch and Rye again, quite often. But also the Neapolitan novels, they never get old. The characters are so gripping, the Elena Ferrante's characters are so gripping. And the storyline is at one and the same time so kind of meandering. It's not like if someone said, "Well, what happened?" that there was some one thing that ever happened that kind of I could always, you know, indulge myself with those. I haven't reread them yet because it's not that long ago that I read them, and there are 4 of them, but I know I will.
This morning, Reno telephoned. I thought he wanted money again, and I was ready to say no. But that was not the reason for the phone call. His mother was gone. Since when? Since 2 weeks ago. And you're calling me now? My tone must have seemed hostile, even though I wasn't angry or offended. There was just a touch of sarcasm. He tried to respond, but he did so in an awkward, muddled way, half in dialect, half in Italian. He said he was sure that his mother was wandering around Naples as usual. Even at night? You know how she is. I do, but does 2 weeks of absence seem normal? Yes. You haven't seen her for a while, Elena. She's gotten worse. She's never sleepy. She comes in, goes out, does what she likes. Anyway, in the end, he had started to get worried. He had asked everyone, made the rounds of the hospitals. He'd even gone to the police. Nothing. His mother wasn't anywhere. What a good son. A large man, 40 years old, who hadn't worked in his life, just a small-time crook and spendthrift. I could imagine how carefully he had done his searching. Not at all. He had no brain. And in his heart, he had only himself.
Madeline Brolly narrating My Brilliant Friend, the first of Elena Ferrante's Neapolitan novels, which is TB22520. It and the other books in the series are also available in Braille and giant print from the RNIB library.
And finally, another book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with listeners.
Well, that would be The Underground Railroad by Colson Whitehead, which is just a fantastic sort of narrative-driven novel about people trying to escape slavery in America. And it doesn't fall into the bear traps of just, you know, of necessarily happy endings of, you know, there are twists in the road. It is brutal without being mawkish. And it expands your understanding of what people can do. both for better and for worse. And it's beautifully written.
The first time Caesar approached Cora about running north, she said no. This was her grandmother talking. Cora's grandmother had never seen the ocean before that bright afternoon in the port of Ouida, and the water dazzled after her time in the fort's dungeon. The dungeon stored them until the ships arrived. Dahomian raiders kidnapped the men first, then returned to her village the next moon for the women and children, marching them in chains to the sea, two by two. As she stared into the black doorway, Ajari thought she'd be reunited with her father, down there in the dark. The survivors from her village told her that when her father couldn't keep the pace of the long march, the slaver stove in his head and left his body by the trail. Her mother had died years before. Cora's grandmother was sold a few times on the trek to the fort, passed between slavers for cowrie shells and glass beads. It was hard to say how much they paid for her in Ouida, as she was part of a bulk purchase, 88 human souls for 60 crates of rum and gunpowder. The price arrived upon after the standard haggling in Coast English. Able-bodied men and child-bearing women fetched more than juveniles, making an individual accounting difficult. The nanny was out of Liverpool and had made two previous stops along the Gold Coast. The captain staggered his purchases rather than find himself with cargo of singular culture and disposition. Who knew what brand of mutiny his captives might cook up if they shared a common tongue?
The Underground Railroad by Colson Whitehead is available in Braille, giant print, and as TB24145. It's narrated by Barney Turpin.
Well, Gary Young, thank you so much for sharing the books of your life with us.
Thank you.
Don't forget that you can share the books of your life by emailing us at the usual address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and to everyone who's been in touch. Read On will be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, why not subscribe to our podcast? We're available from all the major platforms, including iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or just search for RNIB Talking Books in your favourite podcast app. If you need any help, have any questions about the show, or just want to keep up to date with us, why not look for us on Twitter? I'm at Red Sail, that's REDSZELL, and producer Robert is at talking_books. So, farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.